From the state capitol, the Florida Public Radio Network brings you Capitol Report.
The House Redistricting Committee digs deep into the numbers to draw Florida's political maps.
Florida is a diverse state. I mean, when you look at the diversity that we have with African Americans and Hispanics, we certainly have a lot of diversity, and our maps should reflect that diversity, and we think that our maps this year absolutely do that.
Some lawmakers worry the rush to privatize Florida's prison system may cause the state to make a mistake.
So as we're moving forward, I hope that we are looking carefully so there's not an oops, oh, we really can do it cheaper and better.
And we look at one lawmaker's attempt to put parents in the hot seat. Could teachers soon be able to grade parents? I'm Tramell Gomes, and that's all coming up on Capitol Report. The House Redistricting Committee is moving closer to choosing new congressional and state house maps. James Call reports today lawmakers held a three-hour workshop on proposals, and the committee chairman says he intends to bring a plan to the full House in 2 weeks.
The Senate has already passed maps for its 40 districts and 27 congressional seats. The House is digging deeper into the once-in-a-decade task of redrawing Florida's political map. Friday, Redistricting Committee members selected proposed maps to work on at their next meeting. Here, Davey Representative Marty Keir wondered about the shape of a South Florida Senate district.
I just have a quick question. Sure. I've been wondering about District 39.
District 39 currently stretches from the Keys to Hendry and Palm Beach counties. A proposal would give it a couple slivers extending from its current configuration.
You see how it's a big district. But then all of a sudden, there's like a little line that shoots all the way through to butt up against the other majority-minority district. And I'm just wondering, that little line right there, what's the need for it? And does that make a district contiguous?
Florida's Constitution requires districts to be contiguous and compact. Dividing Florida's 19 million residents into equal political districts is a complex job. Lawmakers are required to balance geography, demographics, so-called communities of interest, and protect minority rights to representation. Hillsborough Representative Will Weatherford is leading the House's redistricting efforts.
Florida is a diverse state. I mean, when you look at the diversity that we have with African Americans and Hispanics, we certainly have a lot of diversity, and our maps should reflect that diversity, and we think that our maps this year absolutely do that.
The desire to have the state's political maps reflect Florida's diversity was one of the motivations behind anti-gerrymandering provisions Florida voters approved last November. Critics say Florida's elected leaders do not reflect voter registration numbers. Democrats have the edge in registration. Republicans have supermajorities at the state house and in the congressional delegation. Detractors say this is because of the way the districts are drawn, clumping voters in groups so that one party has an advantage. This is known as gerrymandering. The Fair Districts Amendments 5 and 6 outlawed the practice. And although leaders in the House and Senate have agreed to accept a map that the other chamber has drawn for itself, House Democrats indicate they will attempt to make changes to the Senate map. West Palm Beach Representative Mac Bernard is digging deeper into the numbers. He says he has an idea to redraw three South Florida Senate seats that Bernard says would protect minority voting rights without having a preponderance of minorities in one district.
The proposal that I made in regards to District 29, it changed it to be more compact where it doesn't go into Palm Beach County, and I believe that that's a better explanation of Amendment 5 by it not coming to Palm Beach County, and it stays as a minority-majority seat, and it's compact, and it changes District 33 in Miami-Dade County, where now it's it would be compact, but there would be less minorities also, and then District 31 would get that opportunity to have a coalition district to elect a representative of their choice.
Representative Will Weatherford.
What he's talking about, it's hard to see, it's hard to visualize, because again, when you're explaining what you want a map to look like versus actually seeing what a map looks like, those are two different things. So we will definitely take a look at what he's suggesting, both in the House, the congressional map and the Senate map. I've said from the very beginning that we want a good dialogue and we want everybody's ideas at the table. And so I've encouraged Representative Bernard to bring forth an actual amendment that we can look at and tangibly see, and then we'll make a determination on whether it increases the legal compliance. Mm-hmm.
Weatherford advised the committee to take a week to study the proposed maps. His plan is to have the committee vote on maps for the state house and congressional seats next Friday and for the proposals to go before the full house 2 weeks later. For Florida Public Radio, I'm James Call.
To privatize or not to privatize? That's the question up for discussion in the legislature this week regarding correctional facilities, and it will be up again in the coming weeks. The Senate has already filed a couple of bills, and as Sasha Cordner reports, a House Budget Committee is now looking into the feasibility of the massive prison privatization effort.
Republican Representative Denise Grimsley, the chair of the House Appropriations Committee, set the tone of the meeting, calling it a, quote, budget workshop on outsourcing state prisons. She says the meeting was strictly a question and answer session about the potential to privatize South Florida prisons, nothing more.
I want to be clear about what we're doing today. Since all of us may not be familiar with correctional issues and particularly with correctional privatization, I thought we would have some presentations to describe this issue. Today's presentation and discussion will not revisit what occurred last year or discuss the ongoing litigation.
But the presentation got off to a rocky start as a Department of Corrections official presented figures from last year's data, which included correctional facilities that are expected to close later this year.
Shouldn't we actually look at where we are today? Because the numbers are going to change dramatically since those facilities are now closed.
Mark Talent with the department's budget office tried to justify his findings to Democratic Representative Martin Keir of Davey.
The fiscal year 10-11 per diems are used because it's the last published per diems the department has. If the privatization effort goes forward, we would take these numbers as a base. We would use adjustments to the 11-12 appropriation, the retirement adjustment, and other things that have happened to adjust this number. But it's the last published number we have to go by because we haven't closed the 11-12 year.
But CARE still wasn't on board. He says having false numbers won't help lawmakers make the correct budget decision.
If we make a decision based on the 2010-2011 numbers, then our decision could be potentially disastrous because those numbers are based on every one of the facilities, including the Broward ones and others, which were pretty costly. I actually think even projections for 2011-2012 are more credible than utilizing a 2010-2011 per diem number.
The matter of cost was still a discussion on lawmakers' minds, including Republican Representative Marty Coley of Marianna. She says she wants to make sure the panel does their homework on prison privatization because realizing they made a mistake after the fact would be devastating.
Last week when the governor's proposal was set forth, there was a brief discussion that the food services had been privatized, and then hindsight, they discovered that really it was not cost effective. They reverted back. We as a state could do it cheaper and better. So as we're moving forward, I hope that we are looking carefully so there's not an oops, oh, we really can do it cheaper and better.
Opponents of prison privatization have said that private prisons are not providing much of the required 7% cost savings at all because they are moving sicker, more expensive inmates out of private prison facilities and shifting the burden onto the state. Republican Representative Paige Kriegel of Punta Gorda says he's also heard that from correctional officers in his district who work at Charlotte Correctional Institution.
And the insinuation would be that any real cost savings that are projected here are not based on actual efficiencies of operation, but kind of bureaucratic sleight of hand.
Though he didn't say that such things have not occurred, a corrections official at the department answered that such moves would be determined by the contract with a private prison management company. Meanwhile, three prison private vendors made their plea to lawmakers. That includes GEO Group, Corrections Corporation of America, or CCA, and Management and Training Corporation, or MTC. All of these companies already operate seven private prisons in Florida. Making his pitch to the House committee, Tony Grande with CCA says if the legislature and the governor allow the private vendors to operate the South Florida prisons, they will come up with innovative solutions that will help Florida.
CCA does not hold the license on great ideas. As much as it's hard to admit, the folks at GEO and MTC are pretty darn smart too. When you give us the opportunity to compete against each other, you're likely to get a solution that's innovative. It's an economic development solution. It brings the highest quality services to the inmate and, most importantly, the best value to the taxpayer.
Still, other members on the panel, both Democrat and Republicans alike, had reservations about the prison privatization effort. But at the panel's end, Republican Representative Chris Dorworth of Heathrow says he feels confident that after listening to the presentations, that prison privatization may be a step in the right direction.
It's obvious that we have a history of working with private prisons in Florida. It's nothing new. And it seems like what's new here is just the sheer depth and magnitude of the potential undertaking. Having said that, we know from our experience that savings can be achieved, and from what I heard today, that can happen without the sacrifice of what is most important, and that is most certainly public safety.
A Senate panel has already filed a pair of bills that would allow the state to privatize about 30 state prison facilities in Florida. The Senate Rules Committee is scheduled to take up the issue Monday, and Senate President Mike Karadopoulos recently released a memo saying it will go to the Budget Committee on Wednesday. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Kortner.
Still to come on Capitol Report, after years of placing more requirements on public schools and teachers, a proposal before lawmakers would let those same educators grade parents.
We've done a lot in education to focus on making sure we have quality, making sure that we have, you know, high standards, and all of those things are only going to be as successful as the input and the involvement of the parent.
Could allowing school boards to sell ad space on school buses lead to even more?
If you pass this, you've also opened our school doors to the ads creeping down the hallway, and they'll jump on those bulletin boards and the lockers, and then they'll be on the toilet seats.
And while South Carolina is having all the fun as voters head to the polls, it will soon be Florida's turn to pick in the Republican presidential primary.
Florida's a tough state to compete in because it has so many media markets and so many different areas of the state with different political and cultural histories.
Over the last few years, Florida has sought to increase accountability in its public schools. Just last year, legislators approved a new law that bases how much a teacher is paid on how well their students perform in the classroom. But public school officials have long complained that they aren't the only factor to a student's success. They say they need help from parents. As Lynn Hatter reports, at least two lawmakers agree with that statement and have filed bills that put the spotlight on parents.
It's crowded in the cafeteria of Bond Elementary School and hard to find a seat as Leon County School District officials finish up one of their monthly town hall meetings with parents and teachers. This time around, the message is about parents and how important it is for them to be more involved in their child's education. It's a message that resonates with Shawanda Cunningham, whose son attends Bond Elementary. She recently moved to Tallahassee from Brevard County and says before the move, her son's grades were mostly D's. But now he's earning much higher scores, which she credits to the work of his new teacher.
Her name is Mrs. Walker. I am able to call her after hours at her home. She calls me. She even calls to come out to visit, to discuss things with me and my son. And I'm just so proud of this school. Also, it's very important for as parents for us to know what's going on with our children. So I really thank the school for what they're doing now and having all the parents come out. And I'm just amazed at all the parents that are out and involved in what's going on tonight. It's really awesome.
Cunningham says she supports a new law that pays and evaluates teachers like Ms. Walker based on how well their students perform. And she thinks a similar idea could work in reverse. That's something Lakeland Republican Representative Kelly Stargell likes too. For the second year in a row, she's sponsoring a bill to let teachers grade the parents.
Well, I'm a parent. You know, I have five children, and it's not just from my personal experience, but studies have shown. But the most important thing in the life of the child is the parent. And we've done a lot in education to focus on making sure we have quality, making sure that we have, you know, high standards, and but all of those things are only going to be as successful as the input and the involvement of the parent.
Stargell's proposal would allow teachers to give satisfactory or needs improvement ratings to parents based on a child's attendance, whether or not the parent has signed all the emergency contact forms, and whether the parent has responded to requests for meetings or communications. There are no consequences if parents don't comply. But not everyone is on board with Stargell's plan.
I'm not sure exactly how The Department of Education intends to use this information.
The Florida Education Association, a teachers union, says it has some reservations. Spokesman Mark Pudlow says he's worried that a seemingly well-intentioned bill could be used against them.
We're concerned about some of the requirements in here and concerned that it's going to give the department another opportunity to grade schools and consequently disparage public education.
The union is also concerned that the bill could lead to a clash between teachers and parents.
It seems to me that what's best for the students is to have parents and teachers working together to improve conditions for kids and improve learning for students. And I'm wondering whether this really sets up a kind of a conflict between teachers and parents.
But Stargell says her bill is largely aimed at getting the conversation started about the need for parents to be more involved.
It's a difficult situation because we have free public education, and we can't demand too terribly much from our parents. That's why there's no repercussions in the bill, because I can't punish a parent, you know, for not doing something.
The measure caused a stir last year and made national news, although it didn't go anywhere in the legislature. Stargell says she's hopeful this year there will be some traction. Meanwhile, Republican Senator Stephen Wise has filed a companion bill in the upper chamber. The focus in the early weeks of the legislative session has been on higher education reform, but there's still lots of time left for the measures to get a hearing. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Lynn Hatter.
You're listening to Capitol Report on the Florida Public Radio Network. I'm Tramell Gomes. Children waiting at the bus stop might soon be the target of advertising. A bill making its way through the legislature would let public schools sell ad spots on the sides of their buses. The idea behind the measure is to provide schools with another avenue for generating revenue. But Regan McCarthy reports some worry about the message those ads might send to children.
Since cars are required to halt when a school bus extends its stop arm to let children board or disembark, some say school buses might be a prime spot for advertising to a captive audience. At least that's what a bill making its way through the legislature suggests. Senator Bill Montford, a Democrat from Tallahassee, is sponsoring Senate Bill 344. Montford says his bill, which would let school boards opt to sell ad spots on their buses, will help schools generate income.
Considering the fact that school districts have little control over the rising cost of transportation, this bill provides a necessary source of revenue in the challenging economic times.
Montford says the bill restricts what types of ads can be displayed on the buses.
There will be no alcohol or tobacco products, no political messages, no mature or sexual content. Content that is false or misleading or deceptive in nature are prohibited, nor can they promote illegal or antisocial behavior, contains material that is not child and community sensitive, or content that is discriminatory.
But Republican Senator Rhonda Storms of Brandon says she's apprehensive about the content restriction. Storms says she gets why it's in the bill, but is concerned about it leading to possible legal action. Storms worries schools could get in trouble for being inconsistent in the kinds of ads they allow.
There was a Supreme Court case that said if you object to one something that you said was mature, but you advertise a television show that has mature content, and maybe you're not watching that show, so maybe you don't know if it's your school board member, you don't know what kind of content's on there. The Supreme Court said then you cannot forbid the directly sexual innuendo.
Senator Audrey Gibson, a Democrat from Jacksonville, says a solution might be to allow text ads only.
Wouldn't you accomplish the same thing by maybe, I don't know, Microsoft? If Microsoft just wanted to put Microsoft on the bus and they paid for that without any pictures.
Montford says that's something he'd be willing to consider. But a woman in the audience, Donna Sanford, says the committee needs to stop and think about the potential impact of the bill and allowing any ads at all.
If you pass this, you've also opened our school doors to the ads creeping down the hallway, and they'll jump on those bulletin boards and the lockers, and then they'll be on the toilet seats.
Montford says advertising is already used as a revenue generator in schools.
If you go to by any school, you'll see advertisements on baseball, football fields. School districts sell advertisements in yearbooks and newspapers and so on.
The bill passed through the Senate Transportation Committee 8-2. Republican Senator Greg Evers of Crestview says he's received 61 emails in opposition to the measure, but he voted for it anyway. Evers didn't provide a reason for his vote. Senators Lisbeth Beniquisto and Rene Garcia voted against the bill. A similar proposal is moving through the House. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
Workers in Statue of Liberty and Uncle Sam costumes have started to appear on street corners. That means tax season is here. WMNF's Janelle Irwin reports, a statewide organization that prepares taxes for free for low-income individuals and families kicked off their campaign at Hillsborough Community College in Tampa this morning.
The Prosperity Campaign connects low-income families with programs to help them gain financial stability and find access to quality health care. This time of year, they also push the Volunteer Income Tax Assistance Program, or VITA. Stephanie Litterall is a volunteer tax preparer for that organization.
For VITA purposes, what we define as a low-income family for tax purposes is $49,000 or less. So a good majority of the population in Tampa Bay fits into that scope of $49,000 or less.
That income cap applies to an entire household income. That means a single mom could make more than $23 an hour and still qualify for assistance through the VITA program. A wage like that isn't often seen as low income. That's also one of the reasons not everyone takes advantage of available tax credits. Florida's former chief financial officer and the event's keynote speaker, Alex Sink, said earned income tax credit money gets left on the table more often than it should.
It wasn't being taken advantage of. That the people who could really qualify for it and needed it weren't necessarily filing taxes or understanding that they had the potential of receiving up to a $5,000 check as a refund, in effect.
The earned income tax credit gives more than $3,000 back on a tax return for someone with one child and more than $5,000 for a filer with two children. It's money that can help struggling families and individuals get out of financial trouble or make luxury purchases that add to state revenue. The VITA program has generated more than $65 million in refunds so far. Member of Congress Kathy Castor was a Hillsborough County commissioner in 2005 when VITA began.
And it started off as a rather modest effort, but we knew how important it was to educate folks on the earned income tax credit and the other tax credits are available. And it's important for our neighbors and the families throughout this community because it is an incentive to work.
Stephanie Litterall of Suncoast Schools Federal Credit Union warns people looking for a quick tax refund. According to her, businesses who offer so-called instant refunds are actually signing customers up for high-interest loans. If their refund isn't accepted by the IRS, the customer would have to pay the money back to the lender. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Janelle Irwin in Tampa.
After several twists and turns in the Republican race for the presidential nomination, all eyes are on South Carolina as voters head to the polls tomorrow for the Republican primary. After that, the country's attention will turn to Florida as it holds its primaries a week from next Tuesday. From member station WUFT in Gainesville, Chris Peralta spoke with University of Florida political science professor Michael Martinez about the expected impact of the Sunshine State on the Republican primaries at the national level.
What makes Florida such a crucial state in the primary process?
It's really the first big state that's going to start selecting delegates in the primary process. Iowa, New Hampshire, and South Carolina are all important. Iowa and New Hampshire started to weed out some of the candidates as Bachman and Huntsman and Perry have now dropped out. But Florida being sort of the first big state is an important test for the candidates to sort of make a mass marketing appeal. Florida's a tough state to compete in because it has so many media markets and so many different areas of the state with different political and cultural histories.
The state has the new primary date that it set a while ago. How does that factor in with the importance of the state in the election primary this election year as compared to in previous years?
This year, the Republican National Committee set a rule that the states that had primaries before February would lose half of the delegates to which they would have otherwise been allotted. And so what that means is Florida has 50 instead of 100 delegates going to the Republican National Convention.
And is it fair to say that the cost of moving the primary in the state of Florida a little bit earlier, was it worth the loss of all those delegates?
Well, I think that's the calculation that the Republican legislators had, is that it was worth it, that in the end, what normally happens is that the candidates who survive the early primaries and caucuses, the race is going to narrow fairly, would normally narrow fairly quickly down to three or two candidates, and then states that have their primaries and caucuses late wouldn't really be have a say in who the nominee is going to be.
Thanks to WUFT-FM's Chris Peralta for that interview, and special thanks to you for listening to this edition of Capitol Report. Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are James Call, Sasha Cordner, Tom Flanagan, Lynn Hatter, and Regan McCarthy. Thanks also to the contributing stations along the Florida Public Radio Network. Taylor Cox provides technical assistance for Capitol Report, and I'm Tramell Gomes, inviting you to join us each weeknight for more reports from the state capitol.